now. You're up to date. Hi, everybody. It's time for Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Nice to be with you again. Welcome to not much of November left and to the waning moments of kind of a cold I've had for the last week. The coughing stage now. I hope I can make it through all this stuff. Happy to be here to spend the waning moments of a month you'll never see again. Behind us, of course, the music of Michael Mossman. Tonight, 7:30, Gantner Concert Hall in Eau Claire. It's renowned trumpet player and composer, that guy, Michael Mossman, with Jazz Ensemble 1. You can grab your tickets at the door. Get this, $6 for general admission. Wow. Coming up on today's show, a young author who's coming, making the most of a bit of a roller coaster ride to her dream. Patty Benson is with us to talk about that dream and the road she's on. Brady Mern is back, this time trekking the backstage of the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee and the route between that and the headquarters of the Menominee Theater Guild, where they're putting the finishing touches on their production 12 Angry Men that opens tonight. Jim Oliver Times 2 features Jim's succinct arrangement of what's on stage in West Central Theater venues and a more extended look at one of those productions, White Christmas, from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. And we begin today right here. It was recently announced the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center would be closing its doors. With such a vibrant arts community in West Wisconsin, my thoughts immediately turned to what effect it would have on that vibrancy. So I turned to Rick Vacious, who's been a guest on this program several times, many of those times talking about the center and its activities, and, of course, the just completed for this year Flyaway Film Festival, which called the LPA. Here's the acronym, LPADC, Lake Pepin Art and Design Center. Yeah, it called it one of its homes. Here's the conversation. Tell me about the history of the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center. Is it a seven-year deal? Is that what I read?
Yeah, that sounds about right. You know, the center was founded by Peter Seitz, who's an artist of some note here from the Twin Cities, who lives here now. And he and a group of others founded the center, I think, 7 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a small group, and their idea was to have it be a resource for area artists, because there are a lot of artists that now live in this area and who work in the area. And the idea was to be able to do continuing education, professional development stuff for them, and encourage others to take up the arts and provide a gallery space for shows of those works and other artists that would be brought in to exhibit.
Did they found the concept 7 years ago, or did they found the place? In other words, you guys had a place right at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, the building that we're in, that the Art and Design Center is in now, is the second location in Pepin that the organization has been in. The original location was basically just around the corner from there. And so I think the concept was created before the space was rented for the gallery. And, you know, I think that I wasn't on board at that time, but I think that process took several months. There has been a presence in Pepin with a space and a gallery and things going on for that period of time.
All right. So with such a plethora of people involved in the arts and artists, as you said, it had to have been a tough decision to close the place.
Well, not being on the board of the Art and Design Center any longer, I can't speak specifically to that discussion, although over the years there had been some discussion while I was still on the board about the possibility of retooling the organization to be smaller and lighter and less top-heavy in terms of cost, because the space costs a fair amount of money to heat and run and keep going. So, and the rent was a very heavy burden for the organization, for a small organization to bear.
Okay.
So I know that over the last 6 to 9 months, and maybe even longer, that the organization has had a lot of discussions about what to do and how to reinvent themselves if that was going to be the case, and you know, whether or not a presence with a building and walls to actually have gallery shows on it was something that they needed to continue to have, and clearly the board decided that you know, the time had was up, and that the center itself had sort of run its course in terms of what they were capable of doing as a group to keep it running.
So what you're saying is it was strictly a business decision.
I think so. Again, since I'm not on the board anymore, I can't really speak to that. But I think, arts funding is being cut pretty much everywhere. And I know that fundraising had been tough for the last few years anyway. And I think that, it's just the appetite for going out to that same group of funders again and again and again got more and more difficult over the years. And while I think there were a lot of very generous people who were willing to step up and continue to support the organization and, the notion of having an actual building, I think that the board made a decision that was probably pretty reasonable in their minds, and that, there were other opportunities to continue some of the things that were happening in other ways, and perhaps be more judicious about money and funding and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Are you at liberty to talk about the other ways you just alluded to?
Well, as the executive director of the Flyway Film Festival, we made a decision a couple of years ago to begin the process of breaking off, as it were, from the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center, which is the organization under which the Flyway Film Festival was born. And we felt, as a group planning the film festival, that that decision was right for us, because in order for us to continue to grow and be a standalone organization and business, we needed to graduate, so to speak, from under the wings of the Art and Design Center and be our own entity. And I know that that's happened with other things in the past as well, people that have been doing workshops and classes that were done originally under the auspices of the Art and Design Center being done by people on their own outside of that umbrella. The Wide Spot Performing Arts Center in Stockholm was born under the umbrella of the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center. So, I mean, there's a lot of really big, wonderful things that are happening in the area that the organization has every right to be very proud of. But I think, as a parent organization, I think it was time for them to decide that, the kids have flown the coop. It's time for us to do something else,
sure,
so to speak.
Talk briefly, if you will. I mean, you just mentioned that there's a board. What is the structure of the Lake Pepin? Was it just it's a nonprofit, but it's board run?
Yep, nonprofit, 501c3, run by board members. The board varied from roughly 6 to 8 people on an annual basis. Most of the people living in the area, some living up in the Twin Cities, most of them are artists in their own right and have a love of the community and the organization and wanted to see the arts flourish and grow in this area. And I think, despite the fact that the center itself won't exist anymore, I think the arts itself in the area are in really remarkably good shape. Fundraising is always an issue, but there's plenty of stuff going on around here, and always new things that are being talked about and people developing ideas and that kind of thing. And I think that's really what's so great about it, is that the Art and Design Center in Pepin gave birth to a lot of that stuff and a lot of those organizations. And hopefully, as they continue to grow, we build momentum and keep things going and growing and flourishing in this community.
So is now the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center in the rearview mirror, or can people still attend through, the end of the year, or what's the plan?
Yeah, there's the holiday sale that's going on now through the end of the year. This coming weekend, there's sort of a farewell party to the Art and Design Center as an entity. Folks can come on down and participate in that celebration. There will be music and food and all that kind of stuff, and people can come and see some of the remarkable art that's up on the walls now and in the gallery, and buy some of it for their friends and loved ones as holiday gifts. And once that happens, then, you know, the organization will close their doors and everybody will move on.
Rick Vacious is our guest. We're talking about the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center, and it's closing its doors at the end of the year. Rick, you talked about it earlier, the Flyway Film Festival. What's its future?
Well, we are, the Flyway is its own organization now. Okay. We are incorporated as a nonprofit in the state of Wisconsin, but we had been using the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center space each of the last 5 years as a venue to screen films. So we are currently actively seeking opportunities to continue to have films being screened in Pepin proper. The film festival will continue. There are lots of opportunities for us to do things in the area, and we're looking forward to opportunities for growth into the future. It'll be sad not to have something on the corner of 2nd and Main in Pepin, but you never know. You know, the building may still be available for us to use come next October. Otherwise, as I said, we're, you know, actively looking at options to do stuff in Pepin still. Mm-hmm. And we will continue to do things in Stockholm and hopefully grow beyond those two venues.
Yeah, the whole experience will prove to be somewhat bittersweet in that the Lake Pepin Art and Design Center will be no more, but it appears as if there are enough people and enough people who will not just fold up their tents, who will refocus the energy and make sure that a lot of what has begun will continue.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. I think that's the key thing, is there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of really great creative people, and that energy remains.
Are people talking about brand new things? Are they trying to add to the sweet to the bittersweet by saying, you know what, we can do now that we don't have this, we can blah, blah, blah?
I think there's always lots of creative ideas being hatched around here constantly. Mm. Whether something immediately springs forth as a result of this particular action happening, I guess I don't really know. I'm hopeful that something will, and I'm sure that something will, but what that will be is I think still a little bit unknown to me. Mm-hmm. But I look forward to those opportunities and embracing them when they arrive.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, I'm glad we had this conversation, because I feel a heck of a lot better. I do.
I think it's a shame that the organization is disappearing as it's existed the last several years. But, you know, there's so much creative energy around here now that things will go on and will get better and will change. They'll just be different.
And I'm sure a lot of people listening are feeling better, too, because what we had to go on was a headline, and we didn't really know what that headline meant. And I'm glad we delved into it further, and thank you for taking time with us.
Thank you, Al. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And good luck to everyone over in that West Wisconsin neighborhood, one of our most beautiful along Old Man River. And as things evolve and the blossom after this pruning, be sure we here at Spectrum West hear all about it, okay, so that we can tell everyone else. Thanks to Rick Vacious for agreeing to talk on such short notice. 20 minutes after 5, this is Spectrum West.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, announcing a new location in Eau Claire at the corner of Claremont Avenue and Craig Road. Complete information, including membership and loan applications, is at wisconsincu.org.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Well, you know, this weekend is the big Eau Claire Improv Fest. It starts tonight at 7 in the Little Theater at Memorial High School and continues tomorrow at the Little Theater, the Volume 1 World Headquarters, the Ellie Phillips Library, and Pizza Plus. Info on Facebook at EC Improv Fest. Yeah. We have got lots of Spectrum memoranda today. Wow. For right now, though, Brady Mern is back, and he actually takes us there. Back, I mean, as in backstage, to the Menominee Theater Guild production of 12 Angry Men.
It's not the most expected holiday production, that's for sure. While other companies might put on A Christmas Carol or The Gift of the Magi, the Menominee Theater Guild has chosen 12 Angry Men. And what is the Menominee Theater Guild? Think of it as a theater troupe in exile. Sure, it takes the stage at the Mabel Tainter, eventually, but it doesn't own, it rents. And for this pop-up production of 12 Angry Men, the Guild will set up shop in the Mabel Tainter in half the time it usually takes. The director is Bob Butterfield, and his assistant, the alliterative Chelsea Chase. Chase tells me what we're in for with this play.
It's going to end on a ray of justice and hope, so it's not all doom and gloom. It's heavy, but you get relief at the end.
If you're not familiar, here's a rundown. A young man is accused of killing his father with a knife, and the show opens with a jury of 12 receiving instructions from the ethereal voice of a judge, a reminder of the seriousness of this case. Then it's off for deliberations. If you've done jury duty before, you might be familiar with this next part. On a hot day, somewhere not quite sure where, in the 1950s, it seems everyone's voting guilty. That is, until one man, the man by the window, casts a not guilty vote. And with that, you're locked in for three acts and a very tense hour and 25 minutes. 12 Angry Men sustains a tension so thick you can cut it with a knife. Make that two knives. The play's director, Bob Butterfield, says he's designed it that way.
The set offers no relief for the audience as far as relief from the tension. Everything is to produce that tension-building feeling from curtain to curtain.
Everything, from the lighting to the blocking to the placement of the intermission, it all builds stress. And like a good court show, the devil's in the dialogue, explains Butterfield.
I very much like it because its dramatic effect is because of good dialogue and good character building, and not due to having to have action constantly throughout the course of the play.
All the action, the trips to the water pitcher or to the window, it's just a means for more talk. Such a peculiar Christmas time show has to have a peculiar backstory, and it does.
Reginald Rose wrote the original screenplay for television. It was very popular, and it was the decision was made to put it on the big screen. If I remember correctly, and don't hold me to this, but I believe it was originally scheduled for an hour on television, and then they had to get more to the 90-minute time frame for the big screen, so it was necessary to expound a little bit to get that kind of detail that could take up that 90 minutes involved in the movie. The play is kind of somewhere in between.
What's more, Butterfield claims a personal connection to the 12 Angry Men franchise.
This is one of the first movies that I can remember seeing as a kid growing up. I would like to say that it was as a rerun, not as an original run. I was also always a big Henry Fonda fan, and Henry Fonda's character in the 1957 version is very, very powerful.
If juror number 8, that is Henry Fonda's character, had a superpower, it would be his ability to instill a reasonable doubt. In fact, the moral of the play is about embracing doubt.
What's a guilty man look like?
Bill Byerle, our analog of Henry Fonda, is the show's technical director and juror number 8. Juror number 8. So there isn't any kind of significance to the juror numbers?
Not that I know of. No, I couldn't get very metaphysical over that. I think he just happens to be juror 8, and that's the way it works out.
I would have guessed juror 1 or 12, but right. That's funny. There is no element of numerology to this. So.
No, but there must be some reason to stick with it, because all three movies of this show that I've seen, juror 8 is the same guy.
Hewing close to the script is something both director Bob Butterfield and his details-oriented assistant, Chelsea Chase, are proud of. The whole play is set in the 50s, with props and hairdos befitting the period. But you will find one heavy point of difference. There's no smoking. as Chase explains.
It's written in because obviously in the 50s, smoking happened anywhere and everywhere, and it happened a lot. We didn't know about the health hazards. Like I was talking about before, the details are so meticulous in this that we would have had to choreograph when people are smoking, when they light up, when they put it out, where they put it, how they hold it. Absolutely every little detail for 12 men would have had to been blocked out, and this show is a blocking nightmare already, so we cut cigarettes.
You won't have to worry about 12 angrily puffing chimneys. Somehow the play still manages to be intense. It's the end of Act 1, time for a 5-minute break, or a chance to catch up with the jurors outside with their cigarettes in hand.
Has this play driven any of you to smoke?
Not
no.
me.
No.
No, of course not. Not
even I've thought less. About it.
Do we have any method actors in the group, people who have taken up smoking just for the production?
No, we don't. There's no smoking in the play, so.
I asked several jurors how they felt about smoking's having been extinguished from this production.
I'm glad that there's not smoking. If they hadn't taken it out, I would have requested that. I don't think it adds anything to it. Yeah, it was the 1950s and everybody smoked,
yeah.
But it wouldn't have added anything to the production.
After all, it would be a lot of smoke. Without even a hint of irony, all the smokers say they're glad there's no smoking, though some say it may have added a little something to do between their lines.
I don't have any lines, so I wish I had something to do.
On my first visit, I head to the big, echoey chamber of the Menominee Theater Guild studio, where an unfinished set exists only as a placeholder. The wood paneling forming the jury room is a technicolored dreamscape, not in keeping with the seriousness of the play. So let's flash forward to move-in day. By the time I arrive at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts at about 4 in the afternoon, much of the work installing the set is already completed. To get behind the stage at the Mabel Tainter Theater, you have to climb up this metal staircase, and it looks like the kind of place where a semi would drop off props. There, I meet the show's ever-busy assistant director, Chase. She tells me much of the heavy lifting happened right away, and a quick chat with the actors reveals that...
I love it.
They like their new environment.
This theater is such an awesome place. Just to come in here walking and start looking out, the lights coming on, the adrenaline gets pumping.
And you're juror number what?
I am number 10.
Helping to underscore the notion that this is transient theater, I walk back over to the home base of the Menominee Theater Guild.
It's a short walk from the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts to the Menominee Theater Guild studios, about 3 blocks away. And if you can handle the cold, you can walk right over there. And all of this is situated in beautiful downtown Menominee, Wisconsin.
And again, meet with Bill Byerl, juror number 8, this time dressed in his technical director's getup. He's working on some last-minute set decorations.
Right, we'll put in like an old-fashioned, about a 9-inch baseboard, and the window plays kind of a 13th or 14th person role to some extent.
Bill Byerl, and that's where we'll leave it. As the 6 o'clock bell chimes from the nearby UW Stout clock tower, will our heroes know their lines? Will there be a window breaking up the walls of the set? Will the knife and its doppelganger stick in a softwood table that I still haven't seen?
And what'll be the moment you know that this is all ready?
The 10th of December, when the performance is done, that's when everything will... No, I'm just kidding. The actors are ready now. They may not know it themselves. And if you ask them, they probably would say they weren't, but they are.
Director Bob Butterfield. You can see and hear it for yourself starting tonight at 7 p.m. 12 Angry Men at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts. In Menominee, Wisconsin, I'm Brady Merton for Spectrum West.
And I understand we lost a little bit of that report, so you can... WPR.org and go to that column where they have programs. Come Monday, you'll be able to listen to the whole thing on the archives. Technology. Spectrum West at 531. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being here. Volume 1 will be holding their in-store Jingle Jams concerts each Friday and Saturday evening through December 22nd. Tonight it's Brian Bethke, and tomorrow evening it's Adeline Rose. You can glance at the full schedule online at volume1.org/holiday. The New Auburn Community Choir is presenting their 2012 Christmas concerts beginning tomorrow evening at United Methodist Church in Chautauqua, and then Sunday evening at St. John's Lutheran in Bloomer. Concerts next weekend, 7:30 Saturday at the New Hope Lutheran Church in Sand Creek, and 3 p.m. Sunday at St. Jude's Catholic Church in New Auburn. 21st Annual Yold Madrigal Dinner is tonight and tomorrow, beginning at 6:30 in the Ojibwe Ballroom of the Davies Center at UW-Eau Claire. You can get your tickets at the Service Center. Busy time at UW-Eau Claire this Sunday. The Symphonic Choir and UWEC Symphony Orchestra perform, 2 p.m., Gantner Concert Hall. Tuesday, it's the Chamber Orchestra, 7:30 in Gantner. The theater production of How I Learned to Drive opens Tuesday, 7:30 in the Riverside Theater. Performances each night through Saturday. Next Saturday, plus a 1:30 matinee next Saturday, the 8th. The UWEC Clay Club sponsors a ceramics sale Tuesday and Wednesday in Davies Center near the Service Center. That's from 9 to 5. That's kind of cool. I went there last year and bought some stuff as Christmas presents, and it was appreciated. The all-female a cappella group Audacious performs next Friday, December 7th, 7:30 p.m., Schofield Auditorium. Over at UW River Falls, the University Theater presents To Fool the Eye, the classic romantic fantasy, opens 7:30 next Thursday, runs both weekends through Saturday the 15th in the Blanche Davis Theater, the Kleinfeld Fine Arts Building. Tickets at the theater box office. Next Friday the 7th, the UWRF Rad Jazz Series presents the second annual swing dance at the historic Union Depot in St. Paul. It features the UWRF Jazz Ensemble and swing dance lessons. Begin at 6:30. That's cool. Tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow at both 1:30 and 7, it's the play Character Development 2.0 at the Grand Little Theater in Eau Claire, labeled as a play with music, mistakes, and a leap of faith. It's a fun experience with a cast of well-known and talented entrepreneurs from around this area. You can get tickets at 832-7529 at the door, too, I'll bet. Did you know this is the weekend of the 100 Miles of Christmas celebration along the Great River Road and the Minnesota side as well, from Hastings to Winona and from Prescott to Fountain City on the Wisconsin side? The website is www.mississippi-river.org/100miles of fun. Spectrum memo loaded today, as I alluded to a bit earlier. You know, it's good to have Jim Oliver back on the show. That's his name. And here's this week's important compendium, as you know, called On Stage.
Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Bare Bones Ensemble Theater will present its monthly improv Thursday at the Stone Throw in downtown Eau Claire. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater of Hudson opens Guys on Ice tonight and Saturday. The show runs weekends through January 5th. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of White Christmas opens Thursday and runs through Saturday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. 12 Angry Men, produced by the Menominee Theater Guild, opens tonight and runs through December 9th at the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee. The Trial of Ebenezer Scrooge opens next Friday and continues through December 15th at Theater in the Woods in Shell Lake. The Northern Star Theater's Kids on Stage production of Dickens' Christmas Carol will play December 6th through the 9th at the theater in Rice Lake. There are three productions of It's a Wonderful Life playing in the region. The St. Croix Festival Theater production plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday in St. Croix Falls. The production runs through December 23rd. The Space Center for Creativity in New Richmond will perform the show tonight and Saturday and next Friday and Saturday. And the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson production plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday. Junie B. in Jingle Bells and Batman Smells will be presented by the Eau Claire Children's Theater next Friday and Saturday, and December 14th through the 16th at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Mr. Christmas, an original play by Don Hodgins, plays tonight, Saturday and Sunday, and selected weekdays at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through January 13th. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Let's consider making it an Oliver buffet, shall we? When you talk about a white Christmas, we're going to have to imagine one, at least for the time being. So close your eyes, picture your favorite winter scene. Maybe that last scene in the movie when they open the barn doors backstage. It's snowing. They all sing. Yeah. Well, I'll let Jim Oliver take it from there.
White Christmas is a musical based on the 1954 Paramount Pictures film of the same name. The libretto is by David Ives and Paul Blake, with music and lyrics by Irving Berlin. The stage version opened in San Francisco in 2004. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production opens Thursday, December 6th, and runs through Sunday, December the 9th. The show is directed by Nick Sirik, who joins us to talk about White Christmas. Welcome back to Spectrum West.
Thank you.
Well, last year you directed It's a Wonderful Life, and the previous year you directed another presentation of White Christmas for the Theater Guild, so are you becoming the go-to guy for Yuletide classics?
Perhaps for the last 3 years, yes. I don't know that. I certainly enjoy directing, and I enjoy the holidays. So, maybe it'll be a new gig.
Okay. Well, for those of us who remember the 1954 film, it starred Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, Rosemary Clooney, and Vera Ellen. So who plays those leading roles in the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production?
Sure. We have a couple of names who I think you'll recognize, and a couple of new people. Steve Borer is playing Bob Wallace, who is the Bing Crosby character, and he's been on stage quite a lot with the Theater Guild and I think the Children's Theater, and you'll recognize his face. And then also Dustin Hugley is playing Phil Davis, who is the Danny Kaye character, and he's done a couple of things with the Guild. Two new gals, university students, Lauren Anderson and Kristen Althoff, will be playing Betty and Judy Haynes. So,
okay. Well, why don't you refresh our memories on what the show is about?
Sure. It starts in 1944, and you see Bob and Phil and their friend Ralph Sheldrake, and they're on the front, and it's, the middle of World War II, and they're buddies. And you also meet their general, Waverly. Is his name, and you just meet all those characters, and then the show fast forwards to 1954, and in that 10 years, Bob and Phil have really made it big on Broadway, and they are, what does the script call them, recording artists and Broadway stars, and they are on an Ed Sullivan show, and they're then invited to watch the sisters act of Betty and Judy Haynes. They were in the army with their brother, and they kind of hit it off with these two gals romantically, and they decide to actually Phil and Judy kind of hoodwink Bob, and they trick him into going to Vermont for the holidays. Well, when they get to this inn in Vermont, they meet their old general, General Waverly, and he is the owner of the inn and is not very successful. And so they decide, well, they could help him out. They'll bring the Bob Wallace and Phil Davis show to Pine Tree, Vermont. They'll pack the place with all kinds of audience members, and they'll make it big for the general. And so within that, you have that story of helping each other out, helping old friends, being selfless. But also then there's the romantic story. Bob and Betty have always been looking for love, but they're always looking for the right one, and they happen to find it with each other. So
there's all kinds of great music in the,
yes.
The show. Talk a little bit about some of the songs that we'll hear.
Yes. Well, if you're familiar at all with Irving Berlin, I think a lot of these songs will be very familiar to you. Of course, there's White Christmas. But then some of the crossovers from the movie that you'll probably be familiar with are Sisters, The Best Things Happen While You're Dancing, What Can You Do With a General, Count Your Blessings Instead of Sheep, and perhaps maybe some new ones that you might not be familiar with are Blue Skies, I Love a Piano, Falling Out of Love Can Be Fun. A lot of great music, and it's just a lot of fun. And I am a Irving Berlin fan, so this is especially appealing to me.
Let's talk about who the musical director is, the choreographer, orchestra director, all of that stuff.
Yeah. I am lucky enough to have two assistant directors with me, Sandy Barsimian, and she and I worked together last year on It's a Wonderful Life, and actually the year before on White Christmas, and then also Cass Lamb, who I'm lucky enough to coach forensics with. Mm. And the musical director is Luke Otto, who's a university student, very, very talented, and an excellent teacher with the cast. He's just so good with the cast. A little teacher about coming out there. The orchestra director is Julie Mikowski, and also fabulous. And Tessa Hermanson is the choreographer. So, and I worked with her actually 2 years ago. She's very good at that as well.
Okay, what about the technical crew? We can't leave those folks out.
No, can't leave out the technical crew. Actually, Sandy Barsimian has been kind of taking the lead on the technical crew, and she's got a few university students who are helping with the set construction and also the painting. And then we've got Tim White, who is playing the general in the show. He's helped a lot with the set. And then Joel and Ann Eigner, which are their mom and dad of the little girl in the play. Yes.
Okay. He is Nick Sirik, director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of White Christmas. Well, you're a fifth grade teacher at Sherman Elementary School. You sort of flipped back into that role a moment ago.
Yes.
And the head forensics coach at Memorial High School. So let's leave the theater for a moment and talk about forensics, or debate, as it was called when I was in high school back in the dark ages.
Declamation, perhaps?
Declamation as well, yes, indeed, all that stuff. Well, anyhow, as the head coach, do you sit on an elevated stand and observe while your assistants work with the students like football coaches do, or are you a hands-on coach?
I am a hands-on coach, and actually I really enjoy that. I have three assistants. Cass Lamb is one of them. Debbie Brown is another, and she is a library media. She doesn't work in the library, and I always forget her title exactly. She works at central office for the school district and does cataloging for all of the library resources. Mm-hmm. And then also Lois Hodgins, who is the group sales director at Fannie Hill. Uh-huh. And the four of us kind of split up the team and then work with our students. So it's a great, great opportunity for all of us. Uh-huh. So.
Well, one of my great regrets is that I was never able to participate in debate. And when I was in high school, my high school did not offer debate until I was in 12th grade. And by that time, I was just trying to get out of Dodge, and I wasn't getting anything new. So talk a little bit about the value of forensics for students.
Forensics is, at least in Wisconsin, a competitive public speaking. And so the students pick a category, and then they develop some kind of a presentation, and then they present that for a judge and for an audience, and they are then judged on their performance. And really the benefits of forensics are that public speaking and developing the skills that we all need later on in life, whether it's a job interview or it's you go into some kind of public speaking career. And so it's really a great way for the kids and the students to work on those kinds of skills. So,
now, as I mentioned, back in the dark ages, I remember there used to be some interaction between the competitors in debate. Is that no longer the case?
Well, there actually is debate, and then there is forensics. And debate is kind of that, you know, traditional Lincoln-Douglas debate where I'm, you know, on the opposing side, and then you can get up and give your argument and go back and forth. And that's really debate. The forensics is an individual event, but it's also a team event. And the way that works is, for example, I might do a poetry reading. And so individually, I am judged and ranked on my performance. But then with my teammates, we are all collecting, as we speak, speaker points. And then so not only am I ranked as an individual, but then my team gets points based on how well each of the individuals does. Uh-huh. So it's a little of both. So and there are a couple within forensics. There are about 15 different categories, and there are speech categories and there are interpretive categories. The speech categories are more, I guess, what you would say, nonfiction. I pick a topic, I write a speech, and then I deliver that speech at each tournament. And that's very basic. It's a little more than that, but that's kind of in a nutshell. The interpretive side is I pick a story, for example, and then I interpret that story. And again, that's very basic. It's a little more than that, but. Mm-hmm.
Now, speech and theater are sometimes looped together in college programs and so forth. Talk a little bit about how they work together, and how they are valuable, and the experience is valuable for each other, I guess.
Sure. You know, they're very closely related, especially the interp side of the forensics. You know, if you're reading a story or you're doing a solo acting piece, you're really using a lot of the same skills that you would be using in the theater. And really, you know, there's a crossover going both ways. The skills that you would use in the theater are very valuable to the forensic student. And then all of those skills that you're learning, whether it's on the stage at the Little Grand Theater or it's at in the classroom at Memorial High School in the forensics team, those skills that you're learning there are really valuable to those students once they're in college or once they're working on some post-secondary career or, you know, whatever it is, that it's just is a lot of benefits for the kids.
Well, we've been visiting with Nick Surik, who is, in addition to being a forensics coach at Memorial High School, is the director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of White Christmas. The show opens Thursday, December 6th, and runs through Sunday, December 9th at the State Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, use your favorite internet search engine to find the Theater Guild's webpage or simply call 715-832-PLAY. Nick Surik, thanks so much for coming back to talk to us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Support for WPR comes from Ken Vance Hyundai, featuring the new 2013 Hyundai Elantra, now equipped with a 1.8-liter engine and 6-speed transmission with Shifttronic and active ecosystem for fuel economy. More at kenvance.com. Support also comes from Festival Foods, offering gift cards that can be used store-wide for groceries, fruit baskets, party platters, hot deli lunches, bakery items, and much more. Details are at festfoods.com.
Spectrum West experiencing a few little glitches today. I hope you can bear with us and we don't have any more before we conclude. Remember, everything is on our archives at WPR.org. Her name is Patty Benson. She's a senior at UW-Eau Claire studying creative writing. She's listed as a 28-year-old senior, which usually means there might be an interesting story inside about an education interruption followed by a strong determination to finish what she started. She published her first book at the age of 17 and has recently completed books 2 and 3. She writes for young people and she writes about strong-willed people who reside within that same age category, young people. She's one of those folks in whose voice you can hear the resolve to succeed at something she really enjoys. I see that you've been writing since childhood. Do you have all the stuff that you wrote back then? Did you save it all?
I have quite a bit of it, yeah.
Yeah? What did you write about back then?
Monkeys.
Monkeys.
Yeah, I had a thing for monkeys and elephants, and I was always writing stories about them.
From as early as you can remember?
Yeah, my dad used to give me these little, you know, the little tiny flip notebooks that have the little spiral on the top?
You bet.
My dad used to give me those, and I would draw little pictures and write little sentences, and so as soon as I could form sentences, with a pen anyway, I was writing and telling stories in these little notebooks.
Were they long stories or short stories, or did they sort of reflect the age at which you were writing?
It was short.
Did you have an indication then that that's something you wanted to do? It was something that was, you had an insatiable appetite for writing?
I think so. I mean, my parents really seemed to remember me enjoying it, and I can remember in third and fourth and fifth grade really wanting to write, and we'd have writing assignments, and the rest of the class would groan, and I'd be like, sweet. Oh, wait, we can only write 5 pages? Crap.
Yeah, it sounds as if you were destined for it. It does. Well, tell me about The Dream Maker. That was the science fiction story that you had published actually over 10 years ago when you were a high school student, yes?
Uh-huh, yep. I was only 17 when that one was published.
Mm-hmm.
It is a story about a girl that's running away from where she doesn't want to be anymore. And she finds out along the way that she wants to be, she doesn't just want to be like, you know, somebody's pretty little princess, and she doesn't want to be somebody that's held down. She wants to be free, and she ends up making a lot of friends and falling in love. And
wow. Where I read it says it's a science fiction story. Where does that come in?
Yep. Well, they're on a ship, and there's a lot of magic and things like that. It's not necessarily realistic.
A ship or a flying ship?
It's a ship. It's a boat ship.
A water ship.
Yeah, but there's lots of magic going on. So I imagine that's why it ended up science fiction.
All right. So now there's been a 10-year span between well, maybe not between first and second books, but between first and third books. What did you decide that you had to do after The Dreammaker? In other words, when you were a kid, you had this appetite for writing. Then you had this thing published when you were 17. Was it tough for you to hold yourself back and not dive into a lot more stuff? Because it seems to me as if it's pretty smart on your part to decide that you probably needed more education in it and that maybe The Dreammaker was just kind of a bit of young luck.
I think it was young luck. I mean, I had a real good friend at the time, and she managed to get me in with the publishing company. She's the one that pointed it out to me, and my parents were good enough that they signed my contract for me. Like, they had to be there, and because I was under the age of 18 at the time. So it was good that my parents were good enough to take the contract to the lawyer and make sure that, you know, everything was kosher. And, you know, so it was kind of whirlwindy at the time. I mean, I had a book signing and I was in the local paper and all the kids at school knew about it. But I did need more education, and life kind of happened, you know, after that. I mean, I graduated and I helped my mom look after my dad for a number of years. He was very ill. And so that took its toll, and I ended up getting married in that time. And so, I mean, it, you know, I got caught up in life. I still wrote, but I never seemed to get anything finished.
And then you got to a point where you said, okay, that part of my life is past. Now I'm going to write again. Is that the way it went?
Yeah.
Okay.
I finally found me again after all the mess and started writing again.
Well, that had to feel good.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely did. And my professors and my friends were a big help. They kind of let me bounce things off of them and encourage me and, you know.
I shouldn't say much of, but some of what you write, because you were kind enough to send me some things, it has Native American flavor to it. Is there Native American heritage in the family?
There's a little tiny bit, but some of the Native American flavor there comes from, I had a good friend that it was his story that I told in the children's book, and I've got a lot of friends that are of Native American descent, and I'm American Indian Studies minor at UW-Eau Claire, and so I'm sort of immersed in it anyway.
Okay, cool. Our guest is Patty Benson. She's a senior at UW-Eau Claire in creative writing. She's had her second and third books published, third one in publication right now. Does writing, Patty, seem like a job to you, or does it seem more like a hobby?
It seems like life.
That's better.
Yeah, it's what I want to do. It's where I want to be.
Your second book called The Nameless Child, another book about struggling to find something. It appears to me that now that you've divulged a little bit of what happened since high school and today, maybe there's a little bit of first-person stuff interwoven in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think anytime anybody writes anything that they put themselves into, their own lives are in there. And, I mean, you know, I lost my dad eventually, and I ended up getting divorced. And so I had to find myself again in order to write, in order to be able to.
Your latest story was fun to read, Pretty Little Gypsy. I have to admit, the spelling kind of threw me. How could a senior in college spell gypsy that way? Why is it spelled G-I-P-S-Y?
Because according to the dictionaries and online research, and there's two or three different ways to spell it, and that's the one that I found most aesthetically pleasing.
Really?
So I went with it.
You're going to have to jump over a few hurdles from the beginning.
Yeah.
It's a really nice story, but that's okay. You got over that hurdle with me, and that's all that matters for this particular moment in your life.
Yep.
The story's about a girl against the world again, except for her grandfather, who sails his ship. Kind of a paraphrase for your life. You know, she had somebody, her grandfather, who was behind her. I mean, her grandmother was against her getting on the ship, as were other people. But her grandfather said, you know, let her alone. She's having fun.
Yeah, it's definitely a parallel for myself. I mean, I was adopted by my grandparents. So when I talk about my dad, he's really my grandpa. And he was always my biggest fan, you know, my biggest cheerleader. And, you know, never, ever, ever tried to squash any dream that I had.
Cool.
No matter how outlandish it was, you know, it was never, that's never going to happen. You're never going to be able to do that. It was always, okay, well, let's figure out how you can accomplish that then.
Wow. Sounds like a great guy.
Yeah, he was.
Well, good that you're right about him, then. He deserves that. Well, not him, but he has a character that's shaped after him, yes?
I'd actually like to write about him.
And you're going to?
I think so. I mean, he was in World War II, and he had a very interesting job post-World War II, and raised kids, and then raised me, and had a wife that he was in love with right up until the day he died, and she's still in love with him, and she's still living, and I think that that would be a really good story to tell.
You bet. And then back to the Pretty Little Gypsy, the young girl stands up to the pirates. Is that you as well?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I feel like it is a little bit.
She finds a sword that fits her?
Yep.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it was fun to read. I see that the Nameless Child has been ordered for the McIntyre Library at UW-Eau Claire. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. One of my professors actually did that for me.
Well, going back to making dreams, as in your first book, tell me about the dreams that you're making now for the rest of your life as a writer. Do you have them?
Oh, definitely. I want to write. I mean, I've got all kinds of stories in progress, and now that I'm sort of finding my feet again in the writing world, I definitely think that you're going to see a lot more from me, and I want it that way. I want to be out there writing, you know, the 3 and 4 book series, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not looking to be, you know, J.K. Rowling or Stephanie Meyer or anything like that. I don't want to be the next Twilight. I just want to write.
Well, that may happen by accident.
It may, but I may be too attached to some of my writing to have some movie director tell me that my characters need to look different than I want them.
Yeah. Well, I think you should just continue writing in those little dinky spirals.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't already, carry on the legacy. It sounds as if you are. It sounds as if you're not letting anything discourage you.
Definitely. Definitely. I don't let anybody tell me I can't.
Good. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yep, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was fun. Spectrum West. Some memos tomorrow and Sunday and next week. Simply Done in Downsville and Acola Gallery of Durand have concurrent holiday open houses, refreshments, guest artists, music, and storytelling, plus door prizes. Details at simply-done.com. The Red Cedar Choir Holiday Concert is Sunday at 2 and 4 p.m. in St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Rice Lake. Admission is simply a free will offering. That's nice. At the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls tonight, it's the string music of Treveld, a trio that plays gypsy, swing, old-time Celtic, bluegrass, blues, and chamber music. Showtime, 7:30. Tomorrow night, the North Winds British Brass Band Holiday Spectacular, 3 p.m. Yeah, tomorrow night, 3 p.m. That makes sense. Well, it's almost dark then, isn't it? We've got lots more coming up on future Spectrum Memos. Thanks to Grace Fair and Hannah Lagerman for promotional support, to Jim Oliver and Brady Mern for their generous contributions, and to you for being the audience that makes it easy to be here every week, and for providing so many of the suggestions and notices that lead to interesting conversations with spirited and creative individuals and organizations. We'll do it again next week. Invite you to stay in touch whenever you can. If you missed some of it tonight, you can go to WPR.org, scroll down the WPR Shows column. I'm Al Ross. Have a great weekend.